Well, here we are at the start of another exciting Failing Writers podcast, and this one is actually quite interesting and exciting.
It is, in equal measure.
We've got a lovely, lovely interview coming up with Queeve McDonnell, who has done lots of things over the years, including stand-up comedy, lots of writing of things, making us feel bad for not really doing anything.
Yeah. He's been quite prolific and quite successful, hasn't he?
Yeah, and now he's got a successful series, several series of books. Kind of comedy, crime, mystery, I guess you'd call it, wouldn't you?
It could be quite depressing, really, to think about the amount that he's done.
It isn't, though, because he's such a jolly man.
He is a very jolly man.
Such a lovely chat with him.
That's true.
I was thinking if he writes as fast as he talks, that's why he's getting through them books, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
We should point out that you won't, as listeners, you won't hear much from us over the next hour or so.
No bad thing.
No.
Could you almost hear the collective cheer of the listeners there, couldn't you?
Listen to somebody else.
Like a few sighs of relief, a few cheers. Yeah, good. But I would recommend, I know some people listen to podcasts like on 1.5 speed or 1.25 speed, kind of get through more stuff. This probably isn't one of the ones you want to do that for.
But yeah, we'll come back at the end to say, how did you like it? Another annoying thing.
We're going to start off with that exact phrase.
Yeah, okay. Exactly like that.
Okay. So remember how you said that. We'll have a listen to the interview, and then that's, you've got it.
Hey, babe, that could become your catchphrase, couldn't it?
It could,
You have to say it in every episode.
How did you like it?
Brilliant. Oh, God. Right. Here's Queeve.
So, we should probably just start by welcoming Queeve McDonnell to the show. Thanks for coming on.
I'm delighted to be here.
Great. We should probably start by pointing out that the way that we kind of know each other, I first met you at the BBC Writers' Room Northern Laughs sitcom initiative back in 2009.
God, that long ago.
But for clarity, I also last met you at the BBC Writers' Room Northern Laughs sitcom initiative back in 2009. So we're not that familiar with each other.
It's been quite the roller coaster ride.
It has.
How have you been?
Well, we have not been doing that great, which is why we started this podcast. And what we like to do is speak to people who at some point had an equal footing to us and then examine how they've managed to become successful whilst we have somewhat floundered.
mate, we were never equal. No, sorry, that's entirely untrue, but it was just too easy, sorry.
That's the key, isn't it? That's the key. But I guess we should start there. Like, was that, do you remember much about that initiative, or was it useful for you?
Just to clarify, just Dave's like desperately hoping that you're going to name in as some kind of muse, or that was the start. Meeting Dave point where it just, everything became clear and I owe everything to Dave.
Well, it's the guy I've spent over a decade stalking ever since that time. So why he has only seen me the once, I have seen him a lot. But yeah, no, it was great. I mean, I do remember because part of that we got to Phil Mealy and Craig Cash were our mentors as part of that, which was pretty cool. And I've been lucky enough to kind of work with Phil on some stuff since then. I've been around his house. He's got a cat. It's lovely.
Nice.
Is that the musical?
No, but weirdly we are writing a musical together.
I heard that on your podcast.
You guys are so much better at asking questions than me, because I was going to say, what kind of cat?
Speaking as a dog lover, annoying, they all are. He also has a wonderful calm energy about him, because my dog is a bit hyper, as we were discussing before, because I should point that out, because he's also in the room as I'm recording this, so he may end up featuring quite prominently. But Phil has a lovely calm energy, where he's one of the people where he walks in and the dog calms down very quickly, because Phil just has that calm energy to him. So in answer to your question, ever since then, my dog's been a lot calmer. Sorry, no, yes. But yeah, it was one of those things where I think with all icon competitions, because someone was asking me about them recently, that they provide focus and stuff, and that was a particularly good one, because you got to work with Craig Cash and Phil Mealy and get feedback from people who really know what they're talking about. So, I mean, it's fantastic. And since then, I've had several sitcoms commissioned, and I haven't. None of them.
Because I remember yours was about death, wasn't it? Or it featured the character death.
Yeah, it was a shameless Terry Pratchett ripoff in hindsight. No, but Yeah, it was exactly that, and then we actually ended up trying to get it away, like with Phil and Craig's company, and at one point we thought we got really close to it getting on Radio 4, because weirdly we put it in, it didn't get through, and they asked us to resubmit it the next year. Like they actually came to us out of nowhere. We were like, oh, okay. And we resubmitted it, and then they said, oh no, it didn't make it again, and we're like, what the?
That's just cruel, isn't it?
Yeah, it was
just rub it in, why don't you?
Yeah, so that was but that's the, I mean, look, I've got so many things in my career that are things like that where you think this is it, and then it isn't, and then it turns out the things that ends up being it is not the stuff you thought it was going to be. But yeah, but it, I mean, anything like that, it's great to sort of get start working with good people. And yeah, since then there's been various different sitcoms and stuff. I mean, I won't give you the whole potted history of my career in one go now, because it'll just involve me talking for an hour and some tears, and the dog's probably going
to
walk out.
I mean, that's basically why we're here.
There does seem to be a lot of stuff, to be
it,
fair.
It does. Now, I'll be honest, now I'm thinking back on it, because I've done a lot of stuff recently where I've been asked about it, you go, wow, there is a lot of stuff that's happened over the thing, different kind of ups and downs. And the great thing about where I am now, and all serious about my career, is only recently, with writing books and stuff, where a lot of things you probably thought were wasted at the time, like, oh, that didn't go anywhere. And the great thing where I am in my career now is, honestly, it kind of feels like everything had a purpose, in the sense that nothing was wasted, if you know what I mean, which is a weird thing to sort of a point to get to.
Yeah, it now
does feel like sort of everything kind of makes sense, because everything has kind of congealed into a happy place, yeah, more or less.
So, because you were a stand-up comedian for quite a while, I think.
Yeah, nearly 20 years.
Was that your sort of, was that your dream when you started out? Is that what you wanted to be? Or was writing always a passion and you just did a bit of stand-up on the side?
It was always sort of, weirdly, I was kind of always half in, half out in some ways, where I kind of wanted to do all that stuff, but I never considered myself a sort of natural performer, because basically I retired. God, I actually retired almost exactly 2 years ago. I should probably check the date. It's the next couple of days, my anniversary. Because I was, for the couple of years before that, I was mainly supporting my two friends of mine on tour. Because I was lucky enough that comedians called Sarah Millican and Gary Delaney are literally my two closest friends in comedy. They're a married couple, as most people now know. And so I was basically supporting the two of them on various tours, travelling around the country, which was lovely. Although when you start doing those kind of gigs, you do quickly lose your thirst to get a stag do from Birmingham to shut up at a club gig. But yeah, so I was kind of doing that. And I've always sort of did both. And I think at different points, if you'd asked me what my goal was, weirdly, I think it varies where you go, oh, I want to be a writer, or I want to be a stand-up comedian and stuff. And because they always felt related. I think one of the lucky things I've had in my career is, if you can, having multiple things like that is great, because I know at different points in my career, when the stand-up was going great, nothing was happening on the writing side. Or if the writing side was going great, you know, things weren't great on the stand-up side. And when you're in the, you're in the arts, when you're self-employed, you know, as we've all seen in the last couple of years, you know, it can be quite brutal, and it's always good to have multiple things going. But even just from a mental health point of view, just to have multiple things that you can, you know, do different things. I think, you know, when you're working on writing, nothing's happening, but you have to do a stand-up gig and it go well, and getting the boost out of that is great. And at the same time, having the things to come back to and work on during the week when you're not doing stand-up, it's just very healthy mentally for you. I think the mix is very good. And the reason I eventually gave up stand-up comedy was just because my books sort of took off, and it just became more than a full-time job. I mean, literally, my wife now gave up her job and she runs the company that does all my books. There's two of us doing it full time, which means the dog.
Is he going to get the dog involved as well?
Yeah, well, it means the dog basically has the world's worst separation anxiety, because he's like, why should anyone? Nobody leaves the house anymore. What? And as soon as anyone tries to, he go cray cray. But yeah, so we've been very lucky in that regard. So, but yeah, and giving up stand up was, I kind of wanted, because you could just sort of disappear, and a lot of people sort of don't retire from stand up, they just sort of disappear or do less gigs and then kind of wander off. And what was nice is I got to go, I wanted to properly finish and say, you know, this is my career, and put a nice full stop in it. And it was great, because I did a club called The Stand in, there's three of them, there's Newcastle, Edinburgh and Glasgow, which are just incredible stand-up clubs. If anyone gets the chance, it is really, there's as I can say honestly now, as somebody who is not looking for gigs anymore, if you want the rankings of clubs you should go to around the country, it is the Three Stands, it is the Comedia in Brighton, the Comedy Store in London more than Manchester. Manchester's good, but London is, you know, London is the best one. Due to the design of the room, which we don't have time to go into now. The Glee Club in Birmingham as well. Those are the kind of places that are the really great ones. I'm sure I'm missing, and there's loads of great independent ones as well, but for the bigger ones, those are the ones. So I got to finish at the Stand in Glasgow, supporting the guy I lived with for a decade, Gary Delaney. And that was lovely, and it was a quite surreal thing. Nice. It's quite surreal to stand on stage and have that thought go through your head going, that bit you've just said, that's the last time you're ever saying that. It's like,
yeah.
And you sort of had that little voice in the back of your head while you were doing your last ever gig going, don't lose focus, but that's the last time you're ever saying that bit. so yeah, it was nice to finish that off, and stand-up's given me so much, both in terms of what you learned as a writer and all that, and also the brilliant people you get a chance to work with. So it's been great.
Interestingly, I got to see something that I wrote absolutely bomb at the Stand in Glasgow. So there's a nice symmetry, isn't there?
Mate, we've all seen that. There's nothing quite like seeing something you've written go in front of a live audience and go, this is terrible. I still have flashbacks to bad previews I've done.
What's the worst one you've ever had?
Oh, my God.
The biggest death on stage that you've had.
Oh, I mean, it'll be in Liverpool because that's where that happens. I really enjoy playing Liverpool, or you know, I used to, but there is a certain way of doing it. There's a great friend of mine, a guy called Jason Cook, he's written the Johnny Vegas things, the detective stuffs that they were on a bus.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's wrote all those as well as lots of other things. He's a very good writer, brilliant stand-up comedian as well. I mean, he's one of the guys who really has done a lot of really good stuff in different mediums. But he had a thing about, I remember talking about playing Liverpool, and there is frankly a certain way you have to play Liverpool, where you have to make it about them and sort of go, oh, you're great, you are. Let me just, like Jason always does think, I'm not even going to talk new stand-up, I'm just going to tell you funny stories that have happened while I'm here. And then he tells stories of various different things he made up in various other places and pretends they're all in Liverpool.
All in Liverpool.
And yeah, and then Jason could rip the room off, because he could absolutely rip the roof off a club. But yeah, so that is but I can remember, dying horribly in Liverpool, where I made a joke. It was flooding. I remember that. It was it was flooding outside, and I tried to make a joke about there was so much flooding. It was a bad joke, but there was so much flooding that I saw. I tried to make some joke about seeing a fish take the hubcaps off a car or something. And the gig already wasn't going well, and they took that to mean you're saying all scousers are thieves. And I was like, no, I was just making a silly joke because there's so much rain about how a fish could theoretically steal the hubcaps off her. Oh God. But yeah, I can remember that being the literally dry, all that thing, like the dry mouth, the sweaty palms, all the stuff you kind of think is nonsense. That all
and then is it just happened. Does it just seem like an absolute age until the end of your
oh I mean it's I made 12 minutes of a 20, and it was you know, and believe me, that's I've done well there compared to what some people manage. And bear in mind, my stand-up, I was quite chatty in the sense I could MC to give, I could talk to the audience and stuff like that as in my career. So I kind of was lucky in the sense I didn't have many deaths. Like, again, Gary won't mind me saying this, Gary Delaney, I don't know if you're aware of him, he's a brilliant one-liner comedian.
He's
right up there with honestly the very best gag writers in the world. He really is. His shows these days are incredible. But Gary won't mind me saying this, Gary's had way more deaths in his career than I have, because he started off being deadpan. And the thing with being deadpan is when it's going great, you rip it up. But if you're dying, you die.
If it doesn't land,
you're not adding much energy to the room, are you?
No.
If it's going bad.
And there's all kinds of gaps for people to come in. So that's the thing. Yeah, whereas you may have noticed, I don't know, this might come as a shock to you, gentlemen, but I speak quite fast. So if if you want to heckle me, you have to really work for it, because there's only a certain amount of oxygen in that room and I'm using most of it. So
you've got to put your hand up to get a heckle.
I mean, you've got to throw an object, and even then it's got to be a good shot.
I always think they should do some kind of psychological study on the mindset of a heckler, because it is a very strange thing, really, isn't it?
It is. That it's really drawing attention to yourself.
You think you can verbally attack someone who stood up there with a microphone, whose job it is to be spontaneous and funny, and that because you've had four pints of Caffrey's, you think that you're going to somehow I don't know. Steal the
show. Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it's invariably. I mean, there are sort of not to. I don't like doing the men say this or women say that, but the reality is most hecklers A are men, and they're generally it's a weird sort of alpha thing trying to prove they're better, because that's one of the things people always ask you about. Oh, I could never be a stand-up comedian because the heckling and stuff. And in all honesty, it was like I'm a highly paid guy. Stand up, no, I'm a paid professional, let's just say that. But you know, I am a professional, I have got a microphone, and I have been doing this for quite some time.
Yeah.
If you can beat me, I deserve to lose badly. now, because the worst heckers is the one, you know, you do get people who are just so horribly disruptive that they don't know they're being an idiot, and they just keep shouting, and they drag a whole show down. But that's like what you actually genuinely fear as a stand-up comedian is being ignored. You fear the room where the sound's rubbish and people are talking amongst themselves.
Yes, that's probably the worst thing, hasn't it?
Yeah.
The spontaneous chit-chat that breaks out.
Or people just...
pure disinterest.
Yeah, and then people just look at... And to be honest, that's an increasingly... You know, again, I don't like this slagging off sort of younger people and stuff, but there was a point in stand-up a few years ago where... You could used to be able to rip the piss out of somebody for their phone and disrupting the gig. And honestly, now people are so attached to their phones that if you actually tell someone to put their phone away, invariably there's a very good chance you will get people looking offended.
It's a hate crime.
It's like, how dare you? I'm Instagramming live.
Before you know it, they put it on Twitter, literally then.
Yeah,
on
so
the
there
phone.
Is, yeah, yeah. It's a very different vibe and live performance in that regard. I can't remember what the question was, and I can't believe that's the answer, but anyway, that's where we ended up.
I'm not entirely sure we actually asked you a question.
Yeah, that's it. Right.
I think it just started happening, and we didn't know how to stop it.
Well, welcome to that.
I'm not saying we mind.
That's
all right.
My autobiography title.
If anything, it's easier for us.
Yeah. Sorry.
Just press play.
Anyway, feel free to throw in some questions.
There's a bit of an interesting balance there, isn't there, from being a stand-up comedian that's very out there on the edge, feeding off people's feedback and kind of being on the stage, treading the boards, to then go and lock yourself in a room and write some books.
Yeah, no, it is very different. And especially, I mean, a lot of people write and they go to the coffee shop and all this, that and the other. I have to be in a room entirely on my own, except possibly for a dog that won't leave.
How do people you can't write a book in a coffee shop, though, can you? Really?
People do all the time. Like,
I know people do, but that's mental, isn't it?
I mean, even like people who can afford to not have to do it in a coffee shop still seem to do it. Some people genuinely can't write in a room on their own. I mean, I'm weird because we're talking on audio, but like behind me, I've got a pin board where I put up all the cards, where I go scene by scene by scene, and I, you know, can turn around and stare at that and talk to it. I mean, I've literally do things like I literally explain to the dog the story because I'm trying just to give me an outlet to explain it. And I don't, because weirdly, my wife is also my first editor. She also manages the other editors and stuff, but she is the first person that reads everything. So I don't, when I'm writing a book, I genuinely don't like asking her questions or explaining problems I'm having, because that influences what she reads when she reads the first
statement. So you use the dog.
So genuinely, I discuss problems with the dog.
Hold on a minute. Is that why you've just got a second dog? You're not happy with the first dog? It's a bad audience.
It's different. He's more of a big picture dog. The other one's much more of a line editing dog. Because he's sort of staffy, and they're much more big questions and just general positivity, and I think you're doing great. Whereas the other one's kind of a sort of abandoned hunting dog from Cyprus, and he's going to be more about your nitty gritty and...
Proper street smart.
Yeah, street smart.
Yeah. Every room's
yeah, exactly.
A staff writer. I've seen a picture of your office. It does look very neat. I mean, it looks a little bit like a sauna with the wood panelling, but it does look very neat, and you've got all the cards in the background. Are you quite an organised writer?
No,
do you like to get things planned out in advance?
I mean, bless you for calling it neat. To be clear, it definitely isn't. And my wife might hear this, so I should clarify, because it's an absolute mess. But it is the one place in the house I can't get given out to, because my wife doesn't even come into it. I'm genuinely very sloppy. But no, it's more about planning stuff out. I think as a writer, when it comes to... I need to have certain points in the book before I start a book. Like, I'm literally just starting a book this week. And I kind of have to have certain points along the journey. You know, it doesn't always have to be the same thing. I don't always have to know what the ending is. I don't always have to know... I generally need the first few chapters, but I need to just know I have certain amounts of the jigsaw puzzle, and then I can figure out the rest as I go. So I'm sort of somewhere, if you know, pantser and plotter, those two things, I'm kind of in the middle of them, weirdly, but probably more on the planner side.
You kind of your pants around your knees.
Yes, exactly. I've got pants on, but not correctly. Right. I mean, not the kind of way you could walk into a supermarket and not get arrested. But yeah, so it's a mix of stuff. But yeah, so I do try. And then there's usually what happens is at certain points when I'm doing the book, I kind of have a sit here for a couple of days and look at the cards and move them round. Because to be very technical, everything I write has ended up being multiple POV. So I have loads of different chapters in different points of view from different characters, which is why the card's so important, because they're color-coded. Like this character's point of view chapters are all this color. And then I can kind of look at them and sort of balance them and move them around, because you don't want too much of one character and too much of another at any given time. So I'm invariably always just sort of pacing things through that way and dealing with a couple of storylines to get them to collide in the happy place they need. Mm. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of that.
Is that a natural... Was that an intentional thing with that narrative?
The multiple points of view, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was... I think...
Or is that just how you roll? Is that, you know, is that just what
I think
came
actually,
out,
I mean, it's a very good question. And I think actually where it comes from is, because I wrote scripts for years. I mean, I only wrote my first book, I'm coming up on the 5-year anniversary of the first one being published in August.
Right, okay.
So before that, I was writing scripts. I'd loaded, you know, I had scripts optioned that never went anywhere and all that sort of thing. I'd loads of stuff that didn't even get optioned. And then, so yeah, but I was even then I was reading scripts. Like I had to, when I decided to write a book, I had to go and find out how to write a book, because I hadn't written prose. I'd just written scripts and scripts and scripts. And I'd read, when I was reading stuff, I generally was just reading scripts and scripts and scripts.
Right, yeah.
And I read script and I thought in script. So I then had to kind of come back and... But the thing then is multiple points of view is very cinematic. It's very TV.
Yes,
So I think that was definitely part of it. Actually, when I started writing my first book, I was doing a master's in creative writing at University of Manchester, which I've never finished. But the lecturer there was really good. I started in first person and he said, this feels like it should be in third person. And I actually rewrote the first couple of chapters and I was like, oh yeah, it should be. And since then, I've never written anything except short stories, maybe in first person. And it just seems to suit my style. And Christopher Brookmeyer is one of my favorite authors and he writes in that style. So I guess I've read all of his books multiple times. So you think, oh, maybe there's an element to that. And Terry Pratchett, again, does multiple POVs.
Yeah.
So I guess that probably felt more natural just because it was something that was used by people whose works I had really sort of drank in over the years just because I was a fan. So I guess it sort of made sense to my brain in a couple of ways because of the TV background and because of who I was a fan of.
So you started off, I think I'm right in saying, you started off self-publishing.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we're still...
How did that come about?
Due to massive disinterest from anyone in publishing. no, genuinely, I mean, basically, A Man in One of Those Faces was a book I wrote that I just thought I was doing it as a practice novel because it was a short story idea that just sort of expanded. And I remember saying to my wife really clearly at the time, I was still working at stand-up and stuff, and I just thought, right, I'm going to write this as a practice and then I'll go back to the other idea I've had, which I still haven't written, by the way. And I wrote it, and then we liked it. We tried to get interested in stuff, and I remember we sent it out, and then bizarrely went on honeymoon. And we got interest within a week from an agent. We thought, oh, brilliant, here we go, here's the frenzy. Nobody else. And that, to be fair, in hindsight, fairly sure that agent was checking if I knew anybody famous who wanted to write a book. do genuinely think that was the case. So we basically, and we actually paid an agent to read it, which was someone suggested to us. And that guy came back with that it was too funny and too Irish. I remember the moment where he gave me that piece of feedback. And then I, very unusually for me, was completely quiet. And then he said,
there's not a lot.
This is too good. I don't want this.
Well, yeah, we basically said that. And then...
Damn it, if only the hecklers at your gigs had known that. If someone could have shouted.
Oh, yeah.
Get off, you're too funny.
You're too funny and too Irish.
That's exactly my point.
You've got me.
He said that and then I went quiet. And then he went, you're going to have to take criticism if you're doing this kind of thing. And I went, sorry, I think the problem we're having is I don't think you've made any. Because I'm literally sitting in an apartment that was paid for by those things.
yes, the problem we've got with this book is it's exactly what you were trying to do.
And then basically, I went to my wife and she went, oh, because we started off, honestly,
And she said, oh, you are Irish, but you're not funny. Don't worry
about
it.
She's never found me to be either of those things. But no, genuinely, the discussion was then, and we started off looking at self-publishing going, oh, frankly, what a lot of people's thoughts would have been on it was like, oh, God, no, there's a lot of awful crap to put self-published. And let's be clear, there is. But there's also, the weird thing that happens with self-publishing is, if people do it badly, everyone goes, oh, God, this self-published book is dreadful. If people do it well, you don't even realise you're reading a self-published book. There's loads of people who are fans of my books.
They don't even know
that they're self-published. And the amount of emails we get on a daily basis, and someone says, your publisher should do this, X, Y, and Z. And then I turn to the wife and go, yes, you should. but yeah, so we literally started doing that way. And people said, the weird thing was because they didn't, there are funny crime books out there, but of course there are. And there's some very fine ones. But because there's generally a sort of wariness in publishing circles to do that, the great thing is that if you actually do it, there's weirdly, traditional publishing is like basically making sure people stay out of your space. They're like, no, no one else does that. It's just him and like three other people we let do that. And they're all doing it themselves. So, and I think that's changing. I think Richard Osman's phenomenal success is obviously, I think, probably tweaking that, and deservedly so, because it's a ridiculous thing. But yeah, so we started doing that. We got interest then for the TV rights and stuff. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's actually announced today on the day we're recording.
They've
been announced as Avalon. Avalon have got the rights, and Debris and Chris Allison is attached to it, which is I'm really excited about. But yeah, but we had sort of interest a couple of years ago, and there was actually, you know, various different things. Frankly, we finally ended up on this, which is we're thrilled with. But that was the thing, like people think, oh, if you're self-published, you can't do this, that, and the other. You know, those are still independently published books. There's actually one coming out next week, and all of those books are still independently published. All of the Bunnyverse, as we call them, which is the books featuring Bunny McGarry and lots of spin-offs. At this point, because I build a universe full of characters, and then I start needing to service them all. So it's like spinning plates where people keep asking about what's happened with Bridget and Paul, and you go, oh God, I've got to write another book.
Oh shit, I forgot I invented
literally
them.
People get annoyed if your imaginary friends don't appear more often. So and we do that, and then we're very lucky where the Stranger Times book, which is published under C.K. MacDonald, that's with Transworld, which is part of Penguin, that came out earlier this year. The first book came out. And they were, and we was, because how that came about was we weren't interested in getting a traditional publishing deal for the Dublin trilogy and all those books, because they're doing well on their own. You don't need, like, you know, if you it wouldn't make sense to establish something as successful and then give it to somebody else to take a large chunk of. Yeah. So, you know, that's something we do ourselves, and it's going, jinx, touch wood, going okay. But my agent was like, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I've got this idea. I actually had it. That's what I said at the start about everything kind of making sense. I had the idea for The Stranger Times as a sitcom about 15 years ago. And I wrote the script, and my agent at the time, I don't think he even sent it to anyone. I think she frankly just read it and didn't get it. And so nothing happened. And weirdly, I just sort of remembered the idea. I decided I was trying to write a serious crime book. Because even then, traditional publishing was like, oh, be good if you wrote something serious. Like, and when I was looking for an agent, I had one agent sort of say about going, so when are you, you know, I mean, these are all well and good, but when are you going to write a serious book? And you're like going, no, I'm not going to, because it'd be stupid. That's like literally, that's like, you know, you don't figure out what you're good at and then chop off your own legs to prevent yourself being able to run just because you like a challenge. I was thinking of all these different ideas. And then literally this popped into my head after a couple of weeks when I was working through these other ideas. And by the time I walked from my then flat to my writing office, I had the whole thing in my head, and it was just, oh, I've got to write this, and it's got to be in Manchester where I now live. And it's one of these things where stuff just made sense. It all came together, and The Stranger Times was born that way. And we went the traditional route with that, and it's been great. You know, it's nice. And we're basically, I'm a hybrid now, which is, jinx, touch wood, it's been working out really good.
Have you found that the readers of the Bunnyverse have followed you to The Stranger Times, or have you found a new audience?
It's kind of what we always hoped would happen is sort of happening, we think, where it's kind of going both ways. Where some people who like the Bunnyverse, because like, you know, the Stranger Times is paranormal, there's werewolves and stuff, and some people just, that would never be their thing. But I think the lucky thing is that because my voice is more or less similar in all the books, so there is the humour and all that. Mm. I think there's the humour, and I think the thing that people do sort of say if they're fans of my books is that they're really drawn to the characters, because I'm a big believer in character over, you know, I think, especially in crime, you see so many books being pushed as the twisty twist you'll never see coming. And I'm just not interested in that. I mean, I've read some of them, they're great. A lot of them are, you know, trying to be those books that are great. Whereas I just believe in if you make characters people like, or not even just like, but they connect with, they will keep reading because they want to see what happens to those characters.
I was going to say, it's just the age-old question, is it, of what's going to happen
to
them?
Yeah, but it's one...
And that's what gets...
Yeah, but exactly that. And it's, as you know yourselves all too well, when you're watching a film and stuff, when you realise it's bad, if you ever watching, I always said to someone recently, if you're watching a film and you realise it's bad, stop it for a second and ask yourself, why is it bad? And invariably it's because, oh, I don't care about any of these people. Like, and once, because if you don't get characters, that's like you've not built the foundations and this whole thing crumbles.
Yeah. I find that a lot in real life.
Yeah, exactly. But that's how people are built. We're built to
hate people.
Yeah, exactly. Bond with people. We don't even
bonds. Yeah. So.
If you're enjoying this podcast, recommend it to your friends. And if you're not enjoying it, well, why not recommend it to people you don't like? That'll show them, bastards.
Yeah. So the Stranger Times has also been a podcast as well, hasn't it?
Yeah,
I think I'm right.
You are indeed.
So you've had people reading the stories.
Yeah, well, basically, yeah. What I actually did was, because I don't know if you've noticed this, with 2020, plans got changed quite a lot. Generally, what would happen was, sort of the book was ready to go, and I'd written a couple of short stories, because what I actually do with my the Bunnyverse things, if you sign up to my mailing list, you get a free collection of short stories, some of which feature characters from the Bunnyverse, and some are just short stories that I've written over the last few years. And we're going to do the same with The Strange Times, so we'll have a giveaway short story just to get people on the mailing list, and it's a good way of getting people, you know, in. And I like writing short stories, more importantly. And I ended up having quite a few ideas, and I started writing them. And then we thought, basically, loads of stand-up comedians I know, all very talented people. Obviously, stand-up comedy has been gone for over a year now. It's coming back now, thankfully. But I knew all these people, and we actually sort of hit on the idea about we should get some of these people to narrate them, and we got them in, and it's been kind of the coolest thing I've ever done in some ways, because we were like, a lot of people had never narrated anything before, but a lot of stand-up comedians are big fans of audiobooks because you drive such long distances, and they were like, oh, I've always wanted to give it a go. So people like, I mean, Hal Cruttendon is a trained actor, but people don't know him as that because he's a popular stand-up comedian, obviously. But he's got great acting chops. He did a great job. There's a lady called Laura Lex, who, again, did her first kind of narration thing outside of her own book that's now out. And she just did an incredible job. And so many other people. People just kept coming in, and it kept being great. We were sending it around people, and we got the samples back, and we're like, wow. So what we've done with the Stranger Times podcast is, they're all stories in the Stranger Times world. But a lot of them don't feature any of the characters that are in the book or anything like that. But they're all... we should explain. The Stranger Times is a newspaper set in based in Manchester that's like the 14 Times. It reports weird news from all around the world. And the pitch is they then sort of realise that some of the news they're reporting isn't quite as fanciful as they thought. And it turns out they are in a world where these things do exist. And there is such a thing as kind of werewolves and vampires and all that kind of magic stuff. And it just in that world, then there's so many opportunities for short stories. I can literally pick up an episode or an edition of the 14 Times, flick through it, and come up with, find weird stories, and they can start, you know, just give you a load of short story ideas. And so we started doing them, and we did it as a podcast, and it's still there if anyone wants to find it, the Strange Times podcast. And we're doing a second series when the second book comes out. And it's just been a great fun to do. And even now, what I'm doing, which is really good, is I'm writing stories where I've already got the voice of who it's going to be reading it in mind. Like, I've got a couple people and said, look, when people said they were interested in doing them, I was like, oh wow, I'll get you for the second series and I'll write one for you to do, which I think is going to be really cool as well. So it's kind of an additional thing that I did really just as a creative enterprise. It's obviously, it's promo for the book, but it's, if you viewed it in sort of nickels and dimes sense, it wouldn't make sense in that regard. But it's just been a brilliant, fun, creative thing to do. Really, really proud of it.
Is that going to develop into a series as well?
Well, it's going to, I mean, at some point...
The Stranger Times has the book, sorry.
Oh, sorry, the book. Yes, absolutely. The second one is in the process of being edited. And it's part of a 3-book deal. And I'm hoping to write more of them after that. And we'll see what happens and all these things. But yeah, and there's been, it's been option for TV and stuff. So we'll see. But adding the option for TV, it's kind of like... Well, you never know. Could go somewhere. Could go nowhere. But it's got a really good company called Playground that made Little Women and a few other things, like really strong pedigree in TV drama and stuff. Because with these things, you're kind of signing your rights away for stuff, and people think you've got way more control as the writer than you do. But I think one of the things, with anyone, why we signed with Avalon, why we signed with Playground, and my agent's really good, and we had the same discussion and agreed, it's like, let's just go with people who've done good work in the past, because that's the best indicator of who'll do good work in the future. And it's been it's a fun idea that people are liking, and it's been going pretty well. So the reviews have been lovely and all that. So it's fun, and it's good to write and think different things. It keeps it fresh for me.
How precious are you about your work going to TV or something? You know, when you're saying that about the possible changes or whatever.
Excellent question. I mean, to be honest, like, for example, without giving too much away, like, one of the first discussions I had with Chris Addison, when we met to discuss the Dublin Trilogy books, like, I don't actually know how he found out about them. He must have been recommended by somebody we both know, and he's read them, really enjoyed them. But we actually said, the way it's set up is I set up a detective agency, and then it kind of gets ripped apart by the end of the fourth book, because there's the trilogy, because there's a prequel in the middle. And so basically the setup is great. And we were saying we might spend more time in the middle with doing more stuff than what happens at the end, you know. And I was like, genuinely coming from my background, I was like, yeah, I mean, I think the characters, as I said, are the key thing. So I think if you're keeping the characters, keeping a lot of the elements of the story, but the TV is a wholly different medium. And I get that. And I would have no interest in, I even wrote a pilot script. And even the pilot script I wrote, it was actually, weirdly, half of it was entirely new. It hadn't appeared in any of the books. Weirdly, the book that's coming out next week, Dead Man's Sins, how that actually came about was I'd written part of it for the pilot, and I really liked the storyline. And then when I came to, I was supposed to do, the next book I was supposed to do was, because basically my main character, Buddy McGarry, goes to America at a certain point, and there's now the McGarry Stateside series, which is a spin-off where there's three of them. I was supposed to write the fourth one, but I needed to go to New York, which I've done before, to do research, because it was very specific, the idea, and you needed to, and obviously couldn't do that in 2020, 2021. So I needed to write something else, and I actually went back and wrote the sequel to the prequel, and it was based off the TV script idea. So it ended up sort of, like, remember I said earlier on about nothing being wasted? That ended up being the spark that started that book off. And then we sort of went through that, and so I kind of understand that the medium is very different, and I think as long as the integrity of the characters is there and the voice is there,
I was gonna say, so you're more precious about the characters and the universe than
absolutely yeah I think yeah stories. As long as the voice is protected and the characters and the same with the Stranger Times and stuff like that, you know, you wait and see what happens with any of these things, but I think as long as you keep the tone of the characters, because bar anything else, I mean, genuinely, as somebody, you know, who's a reader and a watcher of all kinds of TV stuff, if I'm a big fan of stuff, I'm happy to watch something that's a different version of, you know, I don't want to see, I mean, I know, like, for example, the Harry Potter books, I think initially...
Some people get really funny about that.
Yeah, they want, like, I know J.K. Rowling, part of the deal was you have to do the book exactly, and I think they loosen it up in the later films, and I think that's why the later films are stronger, because it's a different medium, there's different things it needs. And I think you have to understand that, and you have to mold it. Now, obviously, there's people... I mean, I don't know if I've not seen The Watch, the steampunk, it's supposed to be Terry Pratchett, one that BBC America did. But I do know how angry Pratchett fans are about it. And like, literally, it's banned as a discussion topic in Terry Pratchett online forums, most of them, because it's just people getting vitriolically angry about it. Now, speaking as a Terry Pratchett fan... And I've read every Terry Pratchett, you know, book several times, and genuinely am a geeky Terry Pratchett fan. I'd happily watch it. I wouldn't, you know, if they. I think the problem is that maybe they haven't been true to characters, and that's what people seem to get really upset about, because a different take on it, maybe, you know. But I still think, and I think they're talking about doing it. I still think now the way things have gone with TV production and what you can do with green screen and stuff, there now is the opportunity to do Terry Pratchett books for the screen properly, as Good Omens kind of proved. And hopefully they will. I mean, the Sky ones and stuff were good before as well, I should say. I'm not slagging them off. But I think there is now a chance to, frankly, Netflix, Amazon, throw a lot of money at it, do a really big, luscious production of what are some of the, you know, they're my all-time favourite books, so I'd be first in line to see them.
Do you get any say at all over the TV adaptation? Do you have any kind of veto or anything, or is it just you hand it over and that's it?
Technically, you know, I mean, as I say, I'm quite new to the process in this regard because my books, you know, being optioned and stuff, but the reality is, the best thing to think about that is James Patterson did a talk at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival a couple of years ago, and he was being interviewed, I think, by Richard Osman, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong on that. But anyway, he was talking about...
He gets everywhere, doesn't he?
Well, Richard Osman was like going to... He was like writing the crime book and stuff. He was kind of in that area. So that's what kind of helped his book go, was like every crime writer in Britain knew him. So it was one of those things where, you know, the book and everything was a very good production thing, as well as being a good book, obviously. But Patterson was being interviewed and he was asked about adaptations of his work. And bear in mind, Patterson's been a massive name in writing for a very long time. And he talked about going to see, I think it was the world premiere of Along Came a Spider, which was a film based on one of his books. And somebody walked on screen at one point and he turned to his wife and went, "Who's that?" And his wife went, I said, "I think that's your main character's sister." And he went, "Okay, since when has he had a sister?" It was literally they just invented this character and he didn't know until that happened. So my point is, if James Patterson has that much control, Muggins is just hoping to get a seat for the premiere.
Good point.
Maybe get invited. Yeah. That'd be nice.
So basically what you do is, genuinely, to go back to what I said earlier, is you basically sign up to help let good people do it. And then let them have at it. And obviously you're there. I'm supposed to be in a consultancy role and everything, and hopefully I will be and all that sort of stuff. But fundamentally, you're involved really as much as they want you to be involved. Unless you're kind of, as you said, you are J.K. Rowling, in which case you've got a fair bit of control. But that's not the exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
Going back to the book version, when you first self-published, how did you build an audience? Or did you kind of, were you kind of piggybacking off your... Or off your fan base?
No.
Existed already.
Let's be clear. As a stand-up comedian, I was a club stand-up comedian. So, like, you know, I could do a good job, but if I didn't, you know, people weren't sitting there going, "Oh my God, Queen's on next." I was just a guy who was on, who the promoters were confident could do a reasonably good job. So it wasn't like people always think that it wasn't a big existing fan base and all that. Really, what we did is there's a lot of information out there now. It's the great thing about sort of independently publishing, as we prefer to call it. Is there's now so much more information, even compared to when we started 5 years ago. And one of the biggest things is, you know, how you find readers, and getting a book out in front of people is tricky. It's always tricky. Even in traditional publishing, it's tricky. That's the reality. There's a lot of books out there. A lot of them disappear without trace in traditional and independent publishing. But we got the book out there. We slowly started getting it around a few people, got a few reviews. And one of the big things is, instead about doing the short stories and stuff, I have now a mailing list of about, I think it's 14,000 people now, I think, who have all at some point moved. Yeah, they've all signed up and got the short stories and stuff, because it's a big fundamental. There's actually a thing called Stranger to Superfan, which is a great book by a guy called David Cochran, who I've since got to know and is a good mate of mine. He's an Irish guy, but he's a real guru in independent publishing. By the way, if anyone here is listening to this, thinking about doing self-publishing themselves, just be aware there are a lot of sharks out there selling products and giving advice and stuff like that. I always say to anyone, David Cochran, all David Cochran does, I think he's a free course he gives away now, and he has books that you can buy for $3.99 in your Kindle, and he's not got they're not leading to the next big expensive product. He just has those and he puts everything into those, and they are brilliant. And if you read David Cochran's books, you get the grounding and what you need to know. I 100% highly recommend them. Anyone who asks me, that's what I say. So we sort of, you kind of start building that way, and it's one of these things that sort of, like, the first book came out and it was doing okay, and then the second book came out and it sort of built a bit. I mean, things like Amazon in general, if you can, one of the best things about being independently published is you're not on a schedule. Like, for example, The Stranger Times, they're basically, we know that there was a book came out this January, and we know there's a book coming out next January, and we know the third book's coming out January after that, because traditional publishing runs on that kind of, you know, schedule. They need to know a couple of years in advance what's happening. Whereas independent publishing, yeah. I had the idea for Dead Man's Sins a few months ago. You know, told my wife about it. We actually, you know, I actually wrote it because I've started using dictation when I'm writing now, which because I was having back problems, and it was literally just a way of getting out of that. But it turns out I'm actually faster if I do dictation than when if I do typing. So the book got, you know, finished in the time it normally takes me, remarkably quickly. And we remember when we sent it to the editors and stuff, when we asked them, can you see any difference between the dictated book and the typewritten book? And they were like, if you hadn't told us, never would have realized that you'd done a different way. So we kind of got that bunk quite quickly, but we can then make the decision back in March or April and go, right, this book's going to come out, and we can then stick it in for June. And the great thing about that is when you're starting off independently published, you can, like I have got now, I said there's the 5th year anniversary, my first book is coming up at the end of August. I've got 11 books now. I think it depends which ones I'm counting, because 10 or 11. But yeah, there's a lot of books out there now. And being independently published, you can do that. You can keep writing the next book and you don't have to wait. And the great thing is then it's a faster way to build a fan base. But the biggest thing is basically if people like your stuff, they need to know where they can go to get more of it. And if you sign up to your mailing list, people have this thing about being very scared to send people an email. Whereas I just do a monthly email where I have a bit of crack. I frankly tell people stories about the dog and silly stuff. But you know, I'm from a stand-up comedy background. If I can't write a funny email, then it doesn't bode well for the books anyway. So we realized that a lot of people actually really enjoy that. And they kind of become super fans. And these are the people then, to go back to your original question about how you get it out. If you start getting a couple of them, they tell people. And it really is word of mouth. Like I'm in a couple of, like, I'm a big fan of the Rivers of London books as well, as Terry Pratchett and those things. And I'm in some of those groups just as a fan before I ever had my own Strange Times book out. And I've had the weird experience now of people I don't know coming in saying they've read the Stranger Times and recommending it to other people in the group, which is really cool. It's obviously terrifying as well, because you're going, oh God, do I read the comments? Because someone's going to be calling it shit. But most people, like, so, you know, they seem to really enjoy it and stuff. And that's really... fundamentally for what it all is, it really does come down to word of mouth, and then just having the structure in place, like having your website and your mailing list and all that stuff, and then mailing your mailing list. Those things just make the difference between people liking a book and maybe forgetting about you when the second one comes around, and remembering buying and becoming. I know we're lucky, we've had people who've bought them all again on audiobook and done all that stuff and recommended it to their friends and stuff, because they feel like they know. Like literally now, my wife, part of her job as a full-time thing is she's in charge of all the emails that come in and responding to people and all that stuff. And we just started doing that on a small level where we had the mailing list. We might get an email once a week from a reader, which was really cool. And now we get 10 or 12 a day, and Elaine responds to everybody. And they're all generally lovely. You get the occasional lunatic, but they're generally lovely. And it's genuinely it's one of the most fun parts of the job. It's nice. And you're just letting people be a fan of what you do, and they're lovely, and it also makes really strong sense commercially.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Have we got any more questions, chaps?
I can't think of anything.
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Right then.
I'm sure there'll be something we forgot to mention. I speak for us all when I say we've run out of bloody questions. You can tell by the awkward little silence no one's filling, till one of us breaks it with a hopeful right there. So all that's left is to thank them for their time before they're leaving. Probably say bye a lot more times than he's actually really needed. Goodbye, thank you, take care, ta-ra, so long. See ya, au revoir.
Oh, they've gone. Well, thank you ever so much for giving us your time. It's been really enjoyable, and
it's been a delight.
Thoroughly interested.
Yes, cool. Thank you, Cuive. We should probably also say that if you want to learn more about Cuive MacDonald, you can go to whiteheadirishman.com, which is easier to spell.
Yes, considerably. That's we've got that. And if you want to learn about the Stranger Times, there's also thestrangertimes.com. I might give you the full thing. And there's the Stranger Times web, yeah. Stranger Times podcast that can be found on most of the pod places.
Yes, we'll pop a link to that.
And it's been an absolute delight, gentlemen. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you very much, Queeve. Good luck with the next book when it comes out.
All right.
Take care, mate.
Cheers, gents. Bye-bye.
Right, Dave, when you're ready, come on, you know what you got to do. Come on. Everyone's waiting.
How did you like it?
Feels like it needs a call and response.
I like it very much.
I like it a lot. It's more like, yeah.
The two-part catchphrase. That's the future. I think we've nailed the secret of success now, haven't we?
Once you got a catchphrase, that's it. You're on the... Yeah. On the home straight. That's what it's all about.
Definitely.
But that was great, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. He's done lots
of
things.
Excellent. Well
done, answer your question, Dave, I liked it a lot.
I liked it also a lot. He's done lots of things, and he seems to have done a lot of them really well.
Yeah, and I just like his sort of irrepressible attitude. Just kind of sort of bounces up from stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He does.
I like that.
I'm
like
reading that. The Stranger Times at the moment as well, which is the sort of new...
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of fantasy series. It's very good. Really enjoying it. And I think he mentioned it. Well, he did mention Terry Pratchett.
We should have had Dave ask his catchphrase question there between when you mentioned you.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah.
But I can recommend that. Get that downloaded on your Kindle.
But yeah, it's had a lot of successes. But it's interesting to hear him talk about the things that didn't work out quite so well. The things that, you know, because it's easy to think if you get something optioned for TV that's it, you've made it. And then lots of things don't ever go anywhere. I think I've had quite a few moments of rejection over the years. Maybe that's something that we should talk about in our next episode.
Oh, yeah, let's delve deeply into your rejection. I think that'd be...
Yeah,
I think that could be a really fun episode.
Huge amount of rejection letters.
I think certainly me and John would enjoy that. I'm not sure, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
here's another
that,
rejection.
Yeah.
How did you like it? Not very much.
Didn't. Bloody rubbish.
So, yeah, we could do that next week. But in the meantime...
Excellent.
If you've liked the show today, you could like it. Subscribe. We've even had a few lovely little reviews that have come through.
Yeah, that always recently. Tickles our insides, doesn't it? It really does.
Yeah.
Just gives our fragile egos a little nice little perk up, doesn't it? When someone says something nice.
It does.
Yeah, a little rub.
Yeah. It makes us record at least one more episode.
Don't say that, because that's going to put some people off leaving a review, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't want to encourage them.
I think some of the really good reviews are trying to make us think... Yeah, we've peaked. Let's just quit. I think that's what the it's a bit of reverse psychology. So don't say that. So yeah, next week we'll talk about rejections.
Yep.
Dave will bring his massive folder of rejections.
Yep.
And settle in for a 3-hour special, I guess.
Great.
Look forward to
it. We'll see you all then.
Bye bye, listeners. Bye bye now.
Tatty bye.
Bye. I was actually waving then, like a children's cartoon character. I don't know if you were.
So long.
Did it come across? Can you tell that on the audio? Doing it now.
I mean, no.
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 We'll bother next time. No.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?